lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left, to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination, and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities, and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups, or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel,
for it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory. You are listening to Lone Wolf Radio, presented and hosted by Tom Metzger. Tom is now broadcasting from a newly relocated and improved bunker in an undisclosed location with internet access across the globe. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode on Lone Wolf Radio.
Is called The Turner Diaries, and in it, the FBI building in Washington is blown up by white supremacists. It may have been a blueprint for what happened in Oklahoma City. It was written by a man who propagates his message through mail order and radio broadcasts. He is part of an increasingly sophisticated network feeding on anti-government feelings. They call themselves patriots. But are they profiting from a message that incites others to violence? CNN Special Assignment correspondent Kathy Sobogan has the first network interview with the author of the Turner Diaries, William Pierce. She begins our look at the anti-government anger that drives patriots and prophets.
At 9:15 yesterday morning, our bomb went off.
These are words from the book, The Turner Diaries.
Most of the victims of our bomb were only pawns. But there is no way we can destroy the system without hurting many thousands of innocent people.
They are only words, but some believe they are words that can kill.
I think there's little doubt that MacDill was simply copycatting the fictional bombing in The Turner Diaries. Almost to the letter.
When you have a man that's writing this type of propaganda, and you've got the folks that we have in this country with access to making bombs and getting a hold of weapons, it's very easy to kill lots of people.
We got a critical!
You're like a big family, a tribe.
This is William Pierce, author of the Turner Diaries.
Of solidarity.
A man many see as the intellect behind the racist movement.
That's why they have promoted every sort of diversity, as they call it. Homosexuals, non-white racial minorities, feminists, their fellow Jews, of course, everybody except normal, healthy, decent white men and women.
With such radio broadcasts and writings, Pierce hopes to rouse what he believes is an angry white constituency. But his real claim to celebrity status in extremist circles is his 1978 novel, The Turner Diaries.
The Turner Diaries has sometimes been called a plan or a blueprint for some of the violence that we've seen in the past decade in this country. I think that's simply nonsense.
The Turner Diaries is a sort of racist fantasy. A small band of revolutionaries committed to a white America eventually overthrows the United States government. Along the way, they slaughter millions of people. Blacks, Jews, and what Pierce calls collaborators. Consider this passage.
Today has been the day of the rope. There are many thousands of hanging female corpses. They are the white women who were married to or living with blacks, with Jews.
Also hanged from lampposts and trees are politicians, reporters, teachers, judges, anyone who rejects Pierce's ideas of racial purity.
Probably the most important idea expressed in the Turner Diaries is that each of us has a responsibility for what's happening in the world around him, that each person has to stop being a spectator and start being a participant.
As I read the book, and I think as many people would read the book, there's another theme, which is essentially a rationalization for killing millions of people because of their race or their ethnic identity or simply because they don't agree with you. Is that a fair reading?
What I said in the Turner Diaries is that we would have ethnic and racial warfare in this country if the trends that I saw when I was writing the book continued. I believe that we will have racial and ethnic warfare.
His violence comes from his pen.
Jerry Dale is a local magistrate and former sheriff who's kept tabs on Pierce for more than a decade.
The Turner Diaries is considered by law enforcement people as being the manual for domestic terrorism.
Villainous, traitorous, cowardly young...
Pierce joined the ranks of extremists when he met George Lincoln Rockwell, head of the American Nazi Party, in 1966. Pierce left behind a career as a physics professor and joined Rockwell's movement.
I think that Hitler was in a position much like the police in Los Angeles when the niggers rioted to the point where there was no more possibility of civil order.
After Rockwell's assassination by a former Nazi sympathizer, Pierce started the National Alliance, the home for his mail order empire. Pierce says the Turner Diaries alone has sold more than 185,000 copies.
The Jews are a people without farmers or workers, a race of parasites.
Pierce also sells works like this propaganda film from Nazi Germany.
The Jews have been this way throughout their entire history.
Pierce reserves his worst venom for the Jews, the people he thinks are running things.
The eternal Jew.
Both the government and the media are in destructive hands and are doing very destructive things to our people today. And that we have to change that. We have to regain control of the power structure in this country.
When you say we have to take control back, control from whom?
From the people who are setting policy in the media now.
But who are these people?
These people are, to a very large extent, members of the Jewish minority in this country.
Yeah.
And here's Pierce on the subject of blacks on a local cable talk show.
If we had left the Africans to themselves, for example, they would still be pulling each other out of the trees and having their relatives for Sunday afternoon barbecue.
Today, Pierce works and lives here on this remote 400-acre compound in Hillsboro, West Virginia, with a few followers. His wife, his fourth, is a mail-order bride from Hungary, who addresses him as Sir. Pierce says that he is a non-violent, law-abiding man, and that his influence is purely in the realm of ideas.
Is William Pierce just an obscure crank with far-out views, or is he the guru of the racist right, the intellectual author of terrorist incidents stretching back more than a decade?
The answers to those questions when we return, as CNN Presents continues with a look at how the stuff of fiction became the stuff of terrifying fact.
We have heard from the author of the Turner Diaries. Who else has heard his message? And what effect have his words of fiction had on reality? Kathy Slobogan continues by following the trail from William Pierce's typewriter to a string of terror incidents in the United States that stretch back more than a decade.
As members of the order, we are to be the bearers of the faith.
Fiction from the Turner Diaries. The reality that followed. On Whidbey Island in Washington State, a small group of extremists ended a violent crime spree in a fiery showdown with federal agents in 1984. Their name, The Order, straight out of the Turner Diaries. Like their counterparts in the novel, their enemies were Jews, blacks, and the government. In a little over a year, they stole $4 million in armed robberies, bombed a synagogue, and murdered three people, including Jewish talk show host Alan Berg, who was machine gunned to death outside his home. The leader of the order was a young man named Robert Matthews, a devotee of the Turner Diaries and a member of Pierce's National Alliance.
Hey, what are these Jews? Get the heck out of here! I didn't come all the way down here to hear you!
I thought a good deal of Robert Matthews. I think that Bob Matthews was a good man because he was a person who was willing to stand up and accept responsibility.
Is it okay with you to assassinate someone?
Yes, it is okay to assassinate someone when one is engaged in a war.
Matthews himself was killed in the fire on Whidbey Island. Several members of the order told investigators that Matthews gave Pierce $50,000 of the take from the armed robberies, a charge Pierce denies.
We've come across the Turner Diaries in almost every single case that we've had against white supremacy, neo-Nazi, Ku Klux Klan type activity that resulted in violence that caused the deaths and injuries to many innocent people.
Morris Dees, who's suing Pierce, has made a career of monitoring racist groups and taking them to court. That earned him a spot at the top of the order's hit list. Dees says the order is not the only group that took its cue from the Turner Diaries. The White Patriot Party of North Carolina was a paramilitary group headed by Glenn Miller. When federal agents raided his home in 1987, they found grenades, pipe bombs, and thousands of rounds of ammunition.
Ready for
he had 1,000 paramilitary people training in the woods, and this guy made sure that every one of them had a copy of the Turner Diaries. It was required reading.
Now the Turner Diaries has turned up again. Timothy McVeigh, the alleged Oklahoma City bomber, read the book while in the Army. According to Army buddies, he carried it with him, recommended it to others, and reportedly even sold it at gun shows.
When he first got it, he read it, I mean, constantly, for 3 or 4 weeks. And he kept wanting me to read it. You've got to read this book.
McVeigh may have even tried to talk with the author of the book. Have you ever talked to Timothy McVeigh by phone?
Never. I've never spoken with Timothy McVeigh by telephone or in person or any other way.
Although Pierce denies it, two separate law enforcement sources told CNN McVeigh's telephone records show he placed a call to Pierce's unlisted phone number in West Virginia in the weeks before the bombing. It was a lengthy call. The content is unknown. But whether or not the two men spoke by phone, clearly something in Pierce's novel spoke to McVeigh.
He picks up the Turner Diaries and sees himself as the hero. Guys like McVeigh see himself as a true patriot in the Turner Diaries, and he doesn't forget about it. He sleeps on it, he becomes obsessed with it, and he acts on it. Like I think he did in Oklahoma City.
We share the same blood. It's true.
Pierce has never been implicated in the Oklahoma bombing, and he rejects the idea that he's responsible for any violence.
And made them hesitate to fight back. I think that illegal or violent activity is completely foolhardy until such time as one can count on support for that activity from a substantial portion of the general population.
We are not engaged in a...
But his tapes and publications take a different tone.
We are engaged in the most desperate war we have ever fought. A war for the survival of our race. And that ultimately we cannot win it except by killing our enemies.
And to rouse the population, Pierce is moving beyond his books and radio shows to a comic book aimed at white teenagers and plans for videos in the future. To reach those white Americans he thinks agree with his message.
There are 100,000 or so of us here today listening to this program who aren't confused or ashamed or guilty.
We are at war with the system, and it is no longer a war of words.
William Pierce says his is still a war of words, for now.
Still ahead on CNN Presents.
Bill Clinton is a criminal because Bill Clinton knows exactly what he's doing.
How does this man profit from the very government he attacks?
On the People's Network, you can hear the host, Chuck Carter, and his guest criticize the government, lay out their conspiracy theories, and sow their version of truth on radio and TV stations across the country. Money from listeners is pouring in, and it's all tax-free. Here's Special Assignment Senior Correspondent John Camp.
I don't think that either administration is serving the American people.
Washington, D.C. is under attack on the nation's airwaves.
We have a government, ladies and gentlemen, that is lying to the people, raping the people, defrauding the people.
In a war of words, radio and television are weapons.
It is high time that somebody start investigating the chief executive officer of the United States government.
One of those on the battlefront is this man.
Hello, everybody. Hi, Chuck Carter for the people.
Well, Chuck Carter claims to be the voice of the little people, providing a forum to many people whose views and opinions are outside the mainstream.
These are very power-hungry and, in my opinion, evil people, in my opinion. And they want all the marbles.
For conspiracy buffs and Americans who don't trust their government, the People's Network has become one network of choice. Founder Chuck Carter has built a mini empire on the anger of the disaffected. His network collects millions of dollars in sales and membership fees from listeners. Ironically, Carter benefits from the government he attacks. His network is tax exempt. So what Carter saves in taxes, he can plow back into his attacks on government. Chuck Carter broadcasts his For the People radio show from the tiny village of White Springs, Florida. Population 700.
You're listening to PRN.
Carter broadcasts from the lobby of this historic hotel. He and his wife bought the hotel in 1990, but no longer rent rooms to the public.
The bottom line is, 30 years ago, this country was number one in the world.
Outside, satellite dishes beam the People's Network programming across the country 24 hours a day. According to Carter, his little network has 282 radio affiliates in 42 states, mostly small AM stations, and 70 television stations that carry a TV version of his show.
This is WQLC-FM.
Chuck Carter's biggest audiences are in small towns like Lake City, Florida.
It's food for thought.
Florida Highway Patrolman Dion Cole is a Carter fan.
I believe what he says because he's done the research, and surely he couldn't say it over the radio if it wasn't fact.
The world press is saying essentially that the Clinton administration is a disgrace.
But many of Carter's facts are in fact
allegations,
such as Iraq.
Allegations of government conspiracies.
Rescue workers being delayed at Oklahoma City while the feds got sensitive documents out of the building.
Allegations of cover-ups of aliens from outer space, like in this People's Network commercial.
Was there secret testing and alien abductions?
Allegations of mysterious black helicopters hovering to spy on and harass citizens.
They've been playing games, war games, essentially against us. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, that is frightening.
Despite this kind of rhetoric, Carter represents himself as primarily a consumer commentator.
You're listening to 1370 AM KWRT in Moonville.
This station carried Harder's show for 2 years. But last January, manager Matt Billings pulled the plug.
I did finally make a decision when one day when the Harder show played President Clinton and Adolf Hitler's voice over the top of each other and joked about the similarities.
Another Nazi Germany in the making with the brown shirts.
That's the first time I've heard that comment. That would concern me, yes, certainly would.
Managers of some stations say they rarely listen to Chuck Carter's show, but carry his program because it's free.
And the UPI News Center in Washington.
And his network provides free hourly newscasts.
Of course, money is a major factor on our AM station, which notoriously costs money to operate each month instead of being profitable.
All the people stocks, plenty of video. People's Network can afford to give away its programming because of what it gets in return.
Just have your Visa or MasterCard ready.
Throughout People's Network programs, commercials promote publications and videotapes, this merchandise that is described as educational material, thus qualifying the network as a tax-exempt company. Much of the merchandise is a spin-off of Harder shows, like this video about implanting computer chips to enslave citizens. The plot was a Harder topic when First Lady Hillary Clinton promoted a national child care program.
She's also saying under her breath, I can hardly wait to implant them so we can track them like laboratory rats.
CNN's inspection of IRS documents discloses Harder's network generates millions of dollars in revenue, more than $4 million in 1994 alone. Most of this coming from the sale of merchandise promoted by his network. Harder's compensation and that of his wife is listed at $57,000, but he also receives other benefits. His tax-exempt organization pays him more than $40,000 a year in rent for his hotel headquarters and another nearby building, an amount about equal to his mortgage payments.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good. How are you?
Although Harder's headquarters is on a public street, on two occasions, People's Network employees tried to stop CNN from videotaping outside, once even calling the police.
As I explained to him, as long as you're on the sidewalk, nothing I can do.
Harder at first refused to do a CNN interview, but on this day a month later, agreed to make himself available, live on his own program.
I have my militia shirt on today, everybody.
During this time, Harder danced around many questions, laughing at reports linking his show to many of the same issues as the militia movement.
Well, you see, the beautiful thing about this broadcast and this network is we let the people talk.
Carter claims 21,000 listeners are currently members of his For the People organization, paying $15 each.
It just seemed to me that the only way was to go independent, find a way for the listeners who wanted to become a member and then support us to do that, and that's what we've done.
We accord nonprofit organizations in society a great many special privileges.
James Bennett, an expert on tax-exempt companies, says operations such as Harder's take advantage of the tax code.
If you're really going to be a nonprofit organization, it seems to me that you should base most of your income on contributions, donations from the public. Of course, here again, the question becomes, what really is public education? What's charity? And we do not have good definitions of these things in the tax code.
Chuck Carter has found a way to use the tax code to legally take advantage of the government he attacks. At the same time, he benefits from the freedoms that allow him to engage in his war of words, a seeming contradiction to much of his anger.
Bill Clinton is a criminal because Bill Clinton knows exactly what he's doing. A lot of people feel disconnected. They feel that Washington is not listening. About our liberty.
have a government, ladies and gentlemen, that is lying to the people.
And I'm not going to give up.
Will you be a patriot?
When CNN Presents continues, the booming business of marketing fear.
Plus, we have customers that are preparing for Armageddon and World War III, too.
Aside to the Patriot Movement, a homegrown industry that puts out the Patriot message in books, pamphlets, and videos, sold through catalogs, on the internet, and at gun shows and survivalist stores, where customers can prepare for everything from a camping emergency to Armageddon. Brian Barger takes us into the world of Patriot business.
We've got a critical...
The latest alert from the Patriot Movement. Allegations of sinister forces in the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. From retired Air Force General Benton Parton.
It could have been orchestrated from anywhere in the world.
Charges that there was more than one explosion.
Column B-3 had to have had a demolition charge on it. There's just no other explanation.
About a third of the building has been blown away.
And the allegation that a fertilizer bomb alone could not have caused the destruction.
I'm not a technician, but I know enough about bombs that I could say that a fertilizer bomb does not have two detonations.
Retired FBI agent Ted Gunderson says the federal government is covering up its own role in the bombing.
I contend that the Oklahoma City incident was created in order to hasten the passage of anti-terrorism legislation that would further erode our constitutional rights and civil liberties.
These theories, rejected by federal investigators and dismissed by the mainstream media, live on in videos, in print, in direct mail catalogs, fax networks, and on the internet. It's all part of a prolific grassroots network of the far right, merchandising fear. Fear of the government, fear of other governments, and fear of other Americans. Among the groups, the John Birch Society, the Christian Identity Movement, Liberty Lobby, and militia groups.
Parton's theories made the cover of The New American, the John Birch Society magazine. Circulation, 50 to 60,000. Got a big spread in Jubilee, a Christian identity paper. And more play in the spotlight, the Liberty Lobby Weekly. Circulation, more than 100,000. Gunderson's theory of government involvement appears on video, sold by the militia of Montana.
The government had access to this bomb that's so complicated that you took it for to detonate it.
Beginning with heavy-handed images of President Clinton and Adolf Hitler, this tape is titled Reichstag 95, an American Holocaust. John Trotman heads the militia of Montana.
We have to create our own means of talking to America if we're going to get the message across.
CNN paid cash for this video. The Montana militia does not take checks or credit cards. Some parts of the militia movement don't trust banks. That makes it impossible to estimate the size of these mail order operations.
Making money on it? No, it's not been a money-making deal. When we sell a videotape for $10 or $15 and we pay priority mail freight, we really don't make much on it.
Trotman would not allow CNN to tape at his mail order center. His group is just one part of a diverse and growing movement, all selling their points of view. Chip Relay monitors the right wing for a liberal research group.
There are 50 to 100 different organizations involved that range from kind of the hard right Birch Society out to the Liberty Lobby, out to the neo-Nazis on the far right, and that there's a tremendous confluence and mix and information exchange across these barriers.
We asked Relay to look at a promotional tape produced by Proclaim Liberty Ministries.
The IRS is controlling the churches.
The tape has excerpts of 55 videos attacking the Internal Revenue Service, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Clintons, and the New World Order. It also offers a selection of anti-Jewish and anti-gay propaganda. The announcer shows how to order.
We avoid using banks at all costs. Accordingly, we ask you to please send only cash.
Postal money orders are acceptable, but the payee line must be left blank.
Why leave the payee line blank?
It turns it into essentially cash, so that it becomes untraceable form of a monetary transaction.
Another catalog, this one from the Christian Patriot Association, features pro-Christian and anti-Semitic themes, with titles like Our Nordic Race and The Jewish World Conspiracy. Some of the groups put a higher value on message than money, urging buyers to duplicate the materials and pass them on.
Most of what we have, there are no copyrights on. We encourage duplication of it.
A favorite place to get the message out is the gun show circuit. There are thousands of gun shows in the U.S. each year, and at many, you can find literature and tapes alongside the weapons.
It's a very fertile place for people who are in those more extreme movements to appear and be sort of the background noise, along with the hundreds of other tables that are just showing different pieces of ordnance or equipment.
CNN found all of the following at gun shows. John Birch Society pamphlets attacking the United Nations and the New World Order. Militia of Montana videos and books. Pamphlets calling for the execution of homosexuals. The Turner Diaries, the novel advocating race war, and a wide selection of anti-black and anti-Jewish propaganda.
Marketing fear has become big business. In the West, where the militia movement is strongest, fear sells. At gun shows, in stores catering to those who want to prepare for the worst.
Harry Wyatt knows all about fear. His store and mail order operation in Utah caters to survivalists. And business is booming.
Probably our most popular kit is this one right here, what we call our Executive 72-Hour Kit. Mm-hmm. It's got everything in there from a shelter, two tents inside, space blankets, water. There's a 44-hour burning candle inside. You can live out of a park if it was necessary with just the items that are inside of this particular kit for two people.
Earthquake kits are just the beginning.
As people are more distrustful of the government, some people become more preparedness-oriented. Just in case, what happens if we had a stock market crash? What happens should tyranny from within happen within the United States?
Wyatt stocks books and gear for any scenario.
We've got a whole section right here on preparing for the New World Order, surviving global slavery. The global slavery is the New World Order. And those people who believe that the government has gone too much are trying to prepare as best they can. Then we have customers that are preparing for World War III and Armageddon.
And then there's the fear about gun control.
You may bear your weapons, and using like containers like these over here, these cash tubes, which have been very popular. Have these been selling more lately? Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, we've sold thousands of those. You could probably put two rifles inside of the containers.
And for customers interested in starting a guerrilla war,
poor man's James Bond.
Well, the poor man's James Bond has been a more popular book of late, wise, just because of the information that's been in there as a result of Oklahoma.
What kind of stuff do we find in here?
You'd find things from everything from booby traps to how to make different kinds of explosives, etc., just using humming things. So I suppose if somebody was really going into a guerrilla warfare type thing, they'd want to have this kind of information.
Right.
Information fueling fear. A healthy fear of government is as old as the Bill of Rights. What is new here is a fear too often based on conspiracy theories which have no grounding in fact. In the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, it is fair to ask whether the merchandising of such fear does anything more than encourage further hatred and violence.
The new war in the West. Why are some government agents living in fear?
I don't want to use the words that he said, but basically he would kill us. I said that I was willing to die. And maybe they're willing to die. I don't know. I didn't show up with a gun. They did.
American West, where the Patriot Movement was incubated, is also the region where anti-government feeling is strongest, driven by anger over land use restrictions. the federal government owns most of the West, as it has since territorial days. Now, anger against the government is escalating into violence, and federal workers are the target. David Lewis reports on the new war in the West.
The American West. A land where the myths of pioneers and cowboys still linger over the desolate and beautiful country. Where the calm solitude masks a battle raging beneath the quiet surface. Many federal agents in charge of public lands in the West feel under siege. Carson City, Nevada, bombs explode near the office and home of a U.S. Forest Service ranger.
I'm sad that someone would express hostility against the work that I do in such a personal and cowardly way.
Reno, another bomb blast on the roof of the Bureau of Land Management.
Most of that damage was here throughout this entire area.
Federal employees feel targeted just for doing their jobs.
I was always very, very proud to say I'm a federal employee, but I'm a little more cautious now.
Government officials say that threats have increased sharply and have become more violent.
No one has claimed responsibility for the Western bombings, but for over a century, these lands have been at the center of a contentious debate. Who should own this land? How should it be used? Now this debate is reaching a boiling point.
Running the government, it's the environmental groups.
Chuck Cushman is one of the key players in a new movement called Wise Use. Its goal, to protect individual landowners from excessive government regulation and environmental extremism.
On the ESA coalition?
I'd like to see us get to the point where we can protect the environment and protect people's rights, too. I think that's possible. I don't think we need to take people's land away or solve every problem that comes up in the environment by destroying communities and destroying people's lives.
Despite the moderate-sounding rhetoric, critics of Wise Use say its organizing tactics and those of Chuck Cushman are anything but moderate.
You'll come into these rural towns where you do have a lot of economic and social stress. Cushman comes in and puts a target on environmentalists and puts a target on Forest Service workers and says, that's your enemy. You know, attack your oppressor. And they do.
Take Burns, Oregon. A small, sleepy desert town that's become a flashpoint in this political debate. Ground Zero is here, the ranch Dwight Hammond and his family have owned for 30 years. The conflict is over the use of federal land, including the spectacular Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, which almost surrounds the Hammond property.
Two-thirds of the way up on that mountain where you see the snow, that's where our cattle are at, we have to cross the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ground to get there.
Yeah. For Dwight Hammond and his family, the issue isn't just some regulatory snafu. They say the government's fences interfere with their cows' ability to graze and get to water. That for them, it's a matter of life and death.
It's our livelihood. It's our it's everything. It's life itself.
Last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service canceled the Hammond's permit to graze on the refuge. The agency cited a long history of violations at endangered wildlife. Problems they didn't have with other ranchers. The cancellation provoked a confrontation.
It was going to get nasty immediately.
The Hammonds placed this piece of farm equipment in the way of a new fence the government was building.
And when they said that they were going to arrest me if I didn't move, I said, well, arrest me.
Hammond was arrested, handcuffed, and taken away. He and his son, Steve, now face federal criminal charges for their actions that day. Hammond says he had to make a stand if his ranch was to survive.
I just felt so bad inside that America could come to this.
Hammond has become a virtual martyr to many in the land rights movement. They say he's an example of a government agency bent on destroying a man's livelihood. But on the
the government side of the showdown, the Hammonds are no heroes.
They were very threatening towards me and towards my staff. And they said they'd wrap a chain around my neck.
Wallace Cameron is the refuge manager who runs the federal land next door.
I don't want to use the words that he said, but basically he would kill us.
Are they lying when they say that there have been threats?
Well, I would just say it's their perception of what was said. I said that I was willing to die. Maybe they're willing to die. I don't know.
Cameron says the threats and Hammond's unwillingness to follow regulations left his agency no choice but to cancel the permit.
It's the public's land. It's a national wildlife refuge. He should be able to abide by some of the conditions that it takes to not be in conflict with that wildlife. And that's all he needs to do.
After Dwight Hammond's arrest, his wife Susie sought out Wise Youth activist Chuck Cushman. He came to Burns and held a rally.
It's a backlash against heavy-handed regulation and intimidation by federal land agencies.
I put signs up on the wall with the names of each of the officers that were involved. It was called the Wall of Shame.
I'm going to read the list of the officials.
And Cushman handed out a flyer that had the home phone numbers of the Fish and Wildlife Service employees.
Phones. I'm not suggesting that you call and harass these people, but these are out of the phone book. These are nothing private.
A lot of them left immediately, got on the phone, and started using those numbers and calling and threatening people on that list.
Cameron's wife, Lynn, was at home when the phone began to ring. She was told to get out of town if she valued the lives of her kids. A caller said, "We know where your children are."
Have you seen him? She really felt like her safety was in jeopardy. And all I could do was just advise her just to leave, just as quick as she could, take the family and leave.
Forrest Cameron holds Chuck Cushman responsible for creating the climate of violence.
He put together the list of phone numbers, including our home phone number, and it worked. There were threats.
And we only have their word to say for it, and up to this point, their record isn't too strong on telling the truth.
But what if it did happen? I mean, how does that make you feel?
Shameful. It's terrible. But it's all out of the phone book. No, and I didn't. No, I made it clear that this was not supposed to be used in an inappropriate way.
The conflict here in America's rural West may signal a larger reality, a growing alienation among those once merely frustrated with the federal government, an alienation that could breed more extremism and danger in its wake.
A year after the arrest and the rally, Burns appears calm again, and at least one side hopes to find a way to resolve the conflict.
What I would like to have happen is to have them come to the realization that it's no longer time just to, if you disagree with something, go take the law into your own hands. It's time to sit down and work things out.
But compromising with the federal government won't be easy for Dwight Hammond or others like him.
We're not going to be knocked out of the way, you know. If they want to bring people in flak jackets, in automatic weapons, like they did with me, come on.
Ruby Ridge, Waco, Oklahoma City, all epicenters of violence, sending shockwaves across the country, all pointing to the next question. Will another incident, regardless of who's at fault, intensify the anti-government anger and bring more Americans into the Patriot movement? Now, here's a look at the next CNN Presents.
We might spend a lot of time with him and find him to be a nice guy, casual, easygoing guy, and never really know what he was thinking.
This is the place where Tim McVeigh grew up. A small town in upstate New York. Traditional. Quiet. Little crime. On the surface, the good life.
19-yard drive, first and 10, Lockport.
What most people knew of Tim McVeigh was also on the surface. Bright, friendly, polite. But he was also a child of divorce, often alone. And he was a young man adrift in a changing economy. Not that different from many in his generation. After Tim McVeigh was named as a suspect, his mother wrote to her local newspaper, "He could be any of our children." One of our own, charged with blowing up 169 people. Tim McVeigh's father, Bill, worked the swing shift at the local GM plant.
Bill seemed to be very involved in the home. Bill was working nights, so he was there most of the time with the kids during the day.
And even the people from the parish who live here and die here.
Father Belzer has known the McVeigh family almost 20 years.
They don't necessarily choose to be buried here.
He says Bill McVeigh is a quiet man who often runs the local bingo game at his church.
B9.
A man who loves to bowl and putter in his garden.
B14.
But Tim McVeigh's mother, Mickey McVeigh, was different.
She's a very, very beautiful woman, very sultry, intelligent, fun to talk to. She had a group of friends, girlfriends, and she began going out with them, as opposed to staying home and doing the normal routine.
The marriage started to fall apart.
Timothy was in about eighth grade when his mother decided things weren't going well. So she took the two daughters and she went to Florida.
There were other separations, finally a divorce. Friends say Tim organized carnivals at his house, casinos, a haunted house, anything to create the feeling of a happy home. But in a small town, there was talk about Mickey McVeigh leaving her husband. Tim McVeigh told a close friend he hated his mother for breaking up the family. At school, McVeigh was obviously intelligent, but an unexceptional student. When he graduated, he worked at Burger King, an army supply store. Dead-end jobs for someone with his potential. In his father's time, this town was a place that held the promise of a comfortable blue-collar life. But for Tim McVeigh's generation, it was also a place with no future. A place where a high school diploma no longer bought a piece of the American dream. Auto plants and factories shut down. Blue-collar jobs disappeared. Tim McVeigh's father has worked at the same job for nearly 30 years. But for his son, that door was closed. The army offered a way out, and Tim McVeigh signed up.
Bad dogs!
Fort Benning, Georgia, basic training, where Tim McVeigh met Terry Nichols.
Keep it going! Don't give up!
He went straight to Terry Nichols. It was like older brother, younger brother type thing. They both had very right-wing views, conservative. If you said anything about welfare or any government entitlements or anything like that, you'd hear an hour speech from either one of them, you know.
Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols moved with their brigade to Fort Riley, Kansas. There, McVeigh was transformed from a shy, skinny kid to a crack soldier who moved quickly through the ranks.
He was the best soldier I met when I was in the Army, by far. Everything we did, he excelled at.
If McVeigh seemed to find his calling in the military, he was also moving farther from the political mainstream. At Fort Riley, he kept a storage shed off base, stocked with weapons, ammunition, food, and water.
He believed in survivalism. Some kind of catastrophe was going to happen, and he was going to be ready.
While he trained for the Army, McVeigh may also have been gearing up for a different private war. A war depicted in the extremist novel, The Turner Diaries, Described by many as a blueprint for right-wing terrorism, the book involves a band of committed revolutionaries who bomb a federal building and eventually bring down the U.S. government.
When he first got it, he read it, I mean, constantly, for 3 or 4 weeks. And he kept wanting me to read it. You gotta read this book. You gotta read this book.
Privately absorbed in extremist fantasy, publicly he talked about a career in the Army, re-enlisting for 4 more years. He trained relentlessly for his goal, the elite special forces, the Green Berets.
He'd start doing push-ups, sit-ups, push-ups, sit-ups, push-ups. He'd do that for an hour. And he'd load his rucksack up with 80 pounds. And then your rucksack weighs another 20 pounds, so he'd be carrying like 100 pounds. He'd put that on his back, and he'd go 15-mile road march every night. He was ready.
But McVeigh would not get his chance. Weeks before he was scheduled to try out for the Special Forces, he was sent to the Gulf War instead. When McVeigh finally received his orders to try out for the Special Forces 4 months later, he was given only a few days' notice.
He was mad, you know, because he knew he wasn't ready. He knew what it was going to take after he had trained as hard as he did.
McVeigh dropped out of the physically punishing course after 2 days, devastated, according to close friends. By the end of the year, he left the Army, his new career finished. But by all reports, he was still very much a soldier in search of a war.
Next, Terry Nichols, comrade in arms, cohort in anger.
He had this demeanor that he was just angry with the world.
Terry Nichols, the second bombing suspect, seemed a man still in search of a purpose in life. Then he found an alter ego in anger in an old Army friend. Here again, CNN's Kathy Sorbokin.
Paul.
This is gun country, Sanilac County, in what they call the thumb of Michigan.
Oh.
The people here are isolated, and they like it that way.
What a lucky shot.
I thought so. They want to basically be left to do their own thing in their own time, in their own way.
You can't run them all, dude.
And the less interference they have from Washington, the better.
Hey, you did get all the way there.
This is the place where Terry Nichols and his brother James grew up. It's the place Tim McVeigh came to after the Army.
As long as the government stays the way it is, that's how it's going to be. We have no control over anything anymore. So.
A place where mistrust of the federal government runs deep and strong. It's always been hard to make a living in the thumb. But in the last decade, as farm prices plummeted, half the farms in Michigan lost money. The people here were especially hard hit. Hard times deepened the distrust of authority.
Where the resentment comes in for a lot of farmers, I think, is when the banks step in and take the farm away. You're not just taking my job away. You're taking away my way of life.
$25, hello.
Banks were regulated by the federal government, so the federal government became part of the enemy.
When you're out in the open and you start thinking for yourself, the government doesn't make any sense.
James Nichols has always been outspoken about his beliefs.
And I don't trust the government because every time they get into something, they muff it up. They screw it up.
Suspected by the FBI of knowing more about the bombing than he would say, James Nichols was jailed for a month, then released for lack of evidence. He has two passions, farming and his theories about the government. Theories which led him and his brother Terry to renounce their citizenship, their voting rights, even their driver's licenses.
Why did you guys do that?
Because it's part of your process of gaining your liberty back, of being free of a corrupt government.
Terry Nichols shared many of his brother's beliefs, but he was as quiet as James was vocal.
James was always outgoing, and Terry was always there with him, but kind of in his shadow.
Bill Morosky's farm is down the road from the Nichols. He describes the young Terry Nichols as intelligent, with a lot of potential, a man not likely to stay on the farm. But somehow, he always ended up there.
Terry tried his hand at a number of things, real estate, carpentry, the elevator management job. Terry developed, I think, a reputation over the years as somebody who was a starter but not a closer. Coming back to that farm meant he failed again.
Friends described Terry Nichols' adult life as a string of setbacks, a first marriage that ended in divorce, a series of false starts in careers. He enlisted in the Army at the age of 33, where he met Tim McVeigh. But that career ended in less than a year. He had to leave to assume care for his son, Josh.
Terry would stand out in the crowd. He always seemed like he was kind of mad at the world.
What was he mad about?
I don't know, just I think life in general. I think he just thought he got a bad deal, you know?
Terry Nichols tried marriage again, this time to a mail-order bride from the Philippines. But by the time she arrived in the United States, she was pregnant by another man. Nichols adopted her baby and ended up back at the farm with his new family. Once again, something went wrong. One morning, the child was found dead. He had suffocated inside plastic packing material left in his room.
Losing his son affected him deeply. He was totally stunned.
You wanted to have a lot of kids.
Lana Padilla was Terry Nichols' first wife.
What went wrong with Terry? I think his dream of having a family just kind of cracked, and then he was lost and didn't know where to go. And then he met the wrong friend.
The friend was Tim McVeigh. Out of the Army, rootless, moving from job to job, McVeigh drifted between his hometown, the Nichols Farm, and Kingman, Arizona.
He looked like he was ready to go into combat.
Rick Burkett worked with McVeigh as a security guard. He remembers McVeigh's unusual behavior after target practice.
All this gunfire behind us broke out. I'm talking rapid fire. Was firing at a like a 6x6 or 8x8 wooden post, fence post, and he almost cut it in half. Well, we thought that was pretty strange. It was kind of scary.
By now, Tim McVeigh may have found his private war. He wrote to his hometown newspaper, quote, "America is in serious decline. Do we have to shed blood to reform the current system?"
Practically declaring martial law on your street. The New World Order.
Here comes a black helicopter.
At the farm in Michigan, McVeigh spent hours listening to shortwave radio shows ranting about the threat from the federal government.
All the American citizens became the enemy of the U.S. government.
It's a message that plays well in this part of the country, where some people stockpile weapons and supplies against the day when they think the government will come after them.
They have a lot of time to let these kind of conspiracy or paranoia theories fester among themselves. And I think that they kind of feed on each other.
Around the kitchen table, the Nichols and McVeigh shared their beliefs. James Nichols grew increasingly outspoken about government. Paul Isidorek has known the Nichols nearly 20 years. He tried to ignore their political beliefs. Then James tried to enlist his son.
Evidently, James had told him at one or two times about how they're going to kill cops and judges and really clean house on all the local government.
Did you get the sense they were talking about doing away with government officials?
I didn't take it serious, but I guess maybe that's what the heck they was really talking about. Maybe they were a lot more serious than I realized.
Waco may have been the match that lit the fuse. For Tim McVeigh, a call to arms.
I think Tim McVeigh considered himself a soldier and probably still considers himself a soldier in the cause, and had warned on more than one occasion that the cause might be war.
Then we return, strangers in our midst, plotting terror in plain sight.
Nothing, nothing about this man would tell you this man was dangerous.
CNN Presents, a weekly news magazine, continues now with Road to Oklahoma. Once again, here's Bernard Shaw.
It was evil made simple. Homemade terror assembled from everyday parts. Fertilizer, fuel oil, plastic barrels. How could anyone plan all this in plain sight? CNN's Robert Vito continues our story.
In Kansas, early in 1994, a farmhand who had moved from Michigan sent an affidavit to the courthouse in Marion.
Hi, Terry Nichols.
The local prosecutor read it.
He wanted to disassociate himself from his citizenship and from his status as a citizen.
He sent this letter back to Nichols.
If you don't want to be a citizen, then stay off the roads and stay out of the post office.
But by then, Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh were already well on their way along the road that would lead to prison cells in Oklahoma. For the next year, Nichols and McVeigh would stay on the move. Strangers in the small towns where they stopped. All the while, according to the FBI, plotting terror in plain sight. Unnoticed as dissent turned toward destruction. By the spring of 94, Nichols was working as a ranch hand not far from Fort Riley, Kansas. McVeigh was back in Kingman, Arizona, hometown of another Army buddy, Michael Fortier, who now flew up Don't Tread on Me flag above his house trailer. In that summer of 94, when Michael and Lori Fortier were married in nearby Las Vegas, McVeigh would be the best man. Later, CNN sources say on the floor of Lori and Michael Fortier's kitchen in Kingman, McVeigh would use soup cans to show how to arrange barrels of explosives for a bombing. In September, McVeigh would return to Kansas. Within the month, someone would buy 2 tons of ammonium nitrate fertilizer at this farm co-op. Found later, here in Nichols' house, a receipt bearing McVeigh's fingerprint, plus blasting caps taken from a Kansas quarry in October, and guns stolen in Arkansas in November.
We wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas.
On the last weekend before Christmas, while children in Oklahoma City were going caroling, Fortier and McVeigh would drive through the city. Sources tell CNN that two men circled the federal building looking it over. Fortier, who has pled guilty to lesser charges, admits McVeigh told me about the plans that he and Terry Nichols had to blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City. That Christmas day in Oklahoma City, Christopher Wynn, not yet 5, would get his set of Power Rangers, the toy he loved most. Priscilla Salyers, a career secretary with the government, would be sick in bed. Nicole and Scott Williams, married only a year, had just learned they were expecting a baby.
By Christmas, everything needed to bring terror and tragedy to a city and a nation seemed to be at hand. The fertilizer, the blasting caps, the scouting trip to look over the target. Yet the bombers would wait another 4 months. The day had not yet come. The second anniversary of the fire in Waco.
In April 95, McVeigh drove out of Kingman for the last time. On Good Friday evening, he would pull into this motel in Junction City, Kansas.
He was outgoing. He was very talkative.
McVeigh would register under his own name, a mistake that a week later would doom him. Nichols was living a quiet life half an hour away in Harrington, Kansas.
Nothing. Nothing about this man would tell you this man was dangerous.
Easter Sunday in Oklahoma City.
Run for the eggs, my children!
While the children were hunting Easter eggs, the FBI thinks McVeigh drove his old car from Kansas to Oklahoma City to leave it there as a getaway car. The FBI says it was Nichols who drove McVeigh back to Kansas that night. Agents say Nichols admits McVeigh told him something big is going to happen. Monday in Junction City, a Ryder truck is rented with a phony driver's license under a false name, Bob Kling. CNN would find that same name used on credit applications from McVeigh's home address. Back at the motel, McVeigh would park a Ryder truck under the sign in front. Tuesday morning, Geary Fishing Lake. Real estate broker Georgia Rucker drives by, taking her son to school.
We saw a Ryder truck parked down at the lake.
This is where, this is when, the FBI says the bomb was put together. But says the realtor, at least two other vehicles also were parked there. If there were two more people, that raises an ominous possibility.
Then there is someone else that we haven't found. They haven't found.
Earlier that same morning, long before dawn, motel owner Leah McGowan would awake to noises in the night.
So I got up and came in the front office and looked out this window, and I seen the Ryder truck sitting there, and McVeigh sat in the door. The door was half open and the dome light was on, and I could see him looking downwards onto something. I figured it was a map.
An hour later, McVeigh was gone. The truck was gone. By the time the sun rose at dawn the next day, the bomb truck would be crossing into Oklahoma. And 169 people would be waking up on the last morning of their lives.
Each week at this time, for a look beyond the headlines at the most compelling stories of our time. I'm Bernard Shaw, and this is CNN Presents.